Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori on this Saturday morning, September 14th. How are we doing this morning? Looks like it's going to be a mix of sun and clouds today, 67 degrees with a high of 72. Beautiful weekend, hopefully. A little rain maybe in the forecast for tonight. But glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning from 9 to 10 Eastern Standard Time. And you can hear us from anywhere online at 883wppb.org. On my website at annliguori.com, every show is archived. And each show turns into a podcast, which you can hear on Audioboom. And boy, I spent the last 2 weeks covering tennis, broadcasting from the USTA Billie Jean King National Tennis Center. The finals weekend was spectacular. Rafael Nadal winning his 19th Grand Slam title, his fourth U.S. Open title in that epic five-setter against Daniil Medvedev of Russia. Just under 5 hours. I mean, it just went on and on and on. Nadal prevailing in this just incredible battle of determination, will. The rallies lasted forever. And each player just had this incredible hunger to win. And they just, it was like two warriors just, they were just exhausted and trying to come up with any ounce of energy in that fifth set to pull off incredible, just dazzling tennis. And both players were spectacular. Nadal happened to win it 6-4 in the fifth and final set. But, you know, just what an epic battle. If you had a chance to watch it, I know there was a lot going on with football and baseball, but if you could watch, if you watch, especially the last set, you know, it was pretty spectacular. Rafa's coach, Carlos Moya, said afterwards that in terms of excitement and emotion, it was Rafa's biggest victory. And his last four Grand Slam finals, he said, that I've been a part of were difficult to endure and others not as much so. But this is definitely the most significant, especially when you take into consideration factors like the speed of the surface on the hard courts. And, you know, Nadal has won 12 French Open titles. That's on clay, but on hard courts, and you know, it's just, it's a kind of a whole different ball game. But for him to come out and now win his fourth title at the U.S. Open in such an epic fashion, it just really speaks to his longevity and to his determination. And you know, then you start thinking about, you know, the big three. You hear about, you know, this whole debate about who's going to, when all is said and done, come out winning the most Grand Slam titles. You have Nadal now at 19, one behind Roger Federer at 20. And Novak Djokovic is at 16. So Nadal is now, what, three ahead of Djokovic. And it will be fascinating to see who will eventually emerge as the player in the men's game with the most Grand Slam wins of all time. Ironically, these three superstars in tennis have won every Grand Slam championship since the beginning of the 2017 season. Djokovic has won four, Nadal five now, three by Federer. 14 straight, or is it 13 straight Grand Slam titles won by one of these guys, one of these three guys. The last time somebody outside the big three won a major singles title was Stan Wawrinka back at the 2016 U.S. Open. So that's a long span of Grand Slam. You would think there's four Grand Slam championships in one calendar year, and one of these big three have won each of the title, one of these titles since the 2016 U.S. Open when Stan Wawrinka won that one. And they also have a stretch where they won 29 of 30 major titles from the years 2005 to 2012. They've had streaks of 18 and 11 in a row. So, I mean, these talk about longevity. I mean, these guys have been winning for, you know, since 2005. dominating. One of these three guys really winning a major title since then. So when you think about three guys dominating for that many years, it's really a testament to how great they are and how focused they've been and how determined they've been to continue to make history, given the depth in the men's game and how powerful and talented these young guys are. So just incredible. And then, of course, in the women's, you have Serena Williams, who has 23 Grand Slam singles titles, and she's kind of been stuck there since 2017 when she won the Australian Open. Not that long, but, 2 years now. And the Canadian, who's only 19 years old, Bianca Andreescu, surprised her in straight sets. Not really a surprise to those who've been following tennis. I mean, Andreescu won the Indian Wells tournament earlier this year. But Serena, when she has her serve working, I mean, nobody's been able to beat her. Unfortunately, in the final round, she didn't have her serve working. Not to take anything away from Andreescu, who's just been playing incredible. And it's even more remarkable when you think that the first time Andreescu played in the main draw, this is the first year that she's played in the main draw of the U.S. Open, and she wins it. And last year, she lost in the first round of the qualifying tournament. She didn't even get into the main draw. So Serena has been trying to win Grand Slam title number 24 since she last won a major title at the Australian Open in 2017. And the question is, in the women's, will Serena be able to eventually win a record-tying 24th Grand Slam title? It would tie Margaret Court's longstanding record. And then again, if she could do that, she'd only tie it, and then she'd have to win another one to own the record outright. So it will be interesting to see if she can do it. She didn't move that well in the finals. There were two matches in her entire year's Open where I thought she looked really, really good. And then she just kind of gets nervous and she has to get her serve in. But still, playing Bianca, I think, these young women aren't intimidated by Serena Williams anymore. So it will be interesting to see what she can do in the future and how much motivation and hunger she really can maintain to get out there and train and win and deal with all these younger players who are just, so powerful and move so well. In golf, a military tribute at the Greenbrier is going on, and Kevin Chappell carded an 11 under 59 yesterday. Wow, that's the 11th sub-60 round in PGA Tour history. He had back surgery, and this is actually his first PGA Tour event back since recuperating from the surgery. He shot a 71 in the first round on Thursday. And yesterday, he opened with a par on number 10, then he birdied the next 8 holes to make the turn at 28. He birdied number 1, which tied the PGA record for consecutive birdies set by Mark Calcavecchia in the 2009 Canadian Open. He got to 11 under with birdies on holes 5 and 7. Jim Furyk set the record with a 58 for lowest score back in 2016 at the Travelers Championship. So we'll see if he can continue his fine play even with that 11 under. He is 3 shots behind Scotty Scheffler, Joachim Niemann, and Robbie Shelton. So he's 10 under overall and has some work to do this weekend if he's going to, win this event. At the Solheim Cup at Glen Eagles in Scotland, the European team had a 1-point lead over the Americans after the first day. Yesterday of the 3-day competition, the final 2 matches of the 4 balls went to the 18th hole with 2 half points earned by Lexi Thompson and Brittany Altemare. Europe led after the first day of the competition 4.5 to 3.5. American sisters Jessica and Nelly Korda, they teamed up and won 6 and 4 in the morning foursomes yesterday. The only win for the U.S., the only outright win for the U.S., which went into the afternoon 4 balls, trailing by a point. And the Americans have 6 rookies on their team this year, and that's a record. And so far today, from what I can tell, the Europeans are up 6.5 to 5. And sisters, Jessica and Nelly Korda, teamed up again and won their match 6-5, which was a blowout. Morgan Pressel, playing on her 6th Solheim Cup, they came from behind, and she won her match with her partner 2-1. And the four balls are still to come. So the Europeans have a slight edge. So hopefully the Americans can do well later this afternoon. And there's, what, a 5 or 6 hour time difference at this point. They're in Scotland at Glen Eagles, where the guys were for the Ryder Cup a number of years ago. All right, we are going to this morning talk a little golf with Doug Jansen, who is truly one of the great ambassadors in the game. He is the head professional director of golf at Brentwood Country Club. He is a Class A PGA Tour professional. He got his status back in 1990. And, you know, there's a lot. It's a golf course that has a lot of history to it, and Doug's going to tell us all about it. And we will also talk a little bit about, you know, some of the hot topics in golf right now. Obviously, slow play being one of them. And, you know, pretty much the status of the game issue. Like, are we seeing a decline? Are we seeing, you know, more and more young people get into the game? What can be done to get more young people interested in golf? Will Tiger win another major? These are some of the questions that Doug and I will discuss this morning. And then in the second half of the show, one of the greatest basketball ambassadors and just an incredible NBA executive, Pat Williams. He's written over 100 books. He's just had a fascinating life, and he's always one of my favorite guests. Pat Williams, we'll replay a conversation that I had with the great Pat Williams in the second half of the show. So we are going to take a quick break and come back and talk to Doug Jansen, head golf professional at Brentwood Country Club right here on Long Island. Sports Interview with Ann Ligori is brought to you in part by Dune Jewelry and my Hamptons Robe Collection. Savor the memories with sand from your favorite beach or golf course in timeless pieces for men and women. DuneJewelry.com. And by Peak Vision Sunglasses, zero distortion, unmatched clarity, change your game. P-E-A-K, PeakVision.com.
...365 days a year, WPPB is working for you on the air and on our website. WPPB has a helpful community calendar on our site. Just go to 883WPPB.org to the Community Calendar tab and tell us about your activity or event. It's free, easy, and fast. WPPB is the voice of the community, 365 days a year, 7 days a week, on the air and online. Spread the word about your community events. Go to 883WPPB.org.
Hi, I'm Gianna Volpe. I play music that rocks, invite you to East End events that rule, and talk with people all over our Twin Forks on The Heart of the East End. 9 to noon, Mondays through Fridays, on Long Island's only NPR station, 88.3 FM, WPPB, or online at 883WPPB.org.
All we get, then I'ma live with no regret. Life's too short to stress out. Life's too short. I've watched my old man.
Welcome back to Sports Interview with Ann Ligori on this lovely Saturday in September. You can hear us anywhere on the planet, online at 883WPPB.org, and each show is archived on my website at annligori.com and turned into a podcast. And This morning, we say good morning to Doug Jansen, head professional, director of golf at Brentwood Country Club, a Class A PGA professional. And Doug, welcome to Sports Interview. So nice of you to visit with us this morning.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be with you.
We had so much fun. I visited Doug, about a month ago at Brentwood Country Club, and didn't really know much about Brentwood Country Club, Doug. And it's right here on Long Island, not too far away from the East End here. We're in Southampton. But I was fascinated by the club's history. I was fascinated with your story. And, full disclosure, Doug did a club fitting, as we call it. You're going to have to educate everybody on what a club fitting entails. The one we did, it went on and on because it was very thorough. And we went through every club in my bag and just the computer and the technology that, you know, everything you have going to actually really do a custom fitting is fascinating. So I want to get into that a little bit. But first of all, Brentwood Country Club, it's kind of tucked away and not everybody knows about Brentwood Country Club, but it's been around for a long time. And, it's a designer. The designer was very well known, right?
Yes. This is a DevRel product from 1925.
Wow.
Back in the day, this was the sticks. I mean, there was nowhere out here. I think the only thing we had out here was maybe Motor Parkway to get you out here, and that was even probably a dirt road at the time. But DevRel had done a lot of work in the area. There's a lot of his quality work is still available to play and to look at, and withstanding the test of time.
I was looking up DevRel Emmett. He's done so much. I didn't realize, how much he's done. He designed the green course at Bethpage State Park. He's done courses in Maryland, Ohio, Connecticut, the Hartford Golf Club, Larchmont, New York, Bonnie Brier, the Bedford Golf and Tennis Club, Albany, Garden City, Cherry Valley. I mean, this guy has a resume that's just incredible, Doug. And as you say, he goes way back. He was born in Pelham, New York in 1861. So, I mean, what a special track, right? Brentwood Country Club. Yeah, the fact that this guy was one of his many.
Yes, one of many. I mean, some of the ones are very, very local to the area. He did a lot of work. Originally, he was a landscape designer and did a lot of work on the Gold Coast of the North Shore here. And he got moved into golf with a little help doing some consulting work for the National Golf Links out east. And when he started getting involved, I think his very, very first one was the Garden City Golf Club. That was his first track. And that still is in the top 100 in the world today. I think one of his finest and true to form is St. George's. St. George's really is almost identical to what he designed many years ago, and they've done a wonderful job there, keeping it extremely authentic. Another one is Huntington Golf Club.
That's right. There's a whole other list here. There's St. George in East Setauket. I mean, he did Weeburn up in Darien, Connecticut. He did mm-hmm. Wheatley Hills. I mean,
Leather Stocking is another one of his classics. And he did the original design for Congressional. It's been changed several times, but the original starting of Congressional was his work.
Unbelievable resume of works. Truly stunning. So talk about Brentwood and, tell us a little bit about this historic gem.
Well, the golf course was created by DevRel in 1925. Was a private club up until 1972. And the township of Islip took over the property in 72 and made it part of their recreation and parks and recreation division. It's been run since then by the town, and it's been available to the public to play, which is rare. A lot of these golf courses, if you take a look online, are just not available for the public to play. Here, Lenox Hills, which is the green course at Bethpage, those are two of probably the most accessible to everybody. But it's a great little golf course. It's got small greens, well bunkered. The back nine is very heavily tree-lined. It used to be called Brentwood in the Pines many years ago was its nickname. And it will test you. And it's not long because built in 1925. A big golf course back then was around 6,500. This golf course is right around 62, which is a little shorter on today's standard. But the fact that the greens are very small and well bunkered, it keeps everybody pretty honest.
And what are some of the signature holes there, Doug?
Well, I like 17. 17 mm-hmm. was the old 18. A very, very narrow, well tree-lined par 5. Very gettable in 2 if you can find the fairway. And the fairway does get narrow. It gets pinched in with some really 100-year-old pines. And most of my customers are in the shade after their first swing. And they're chipping out and then proceeding from there. But if you find the fairway, it's a nice little risk-reward type. Chase the par 5 and 2. And you got a chance to kind of maybe get one back before the end of the round.
And I'm embarrassed to say I haven't played it yet, but I'm gonna play it soon. Is it hilly or is it flat, or how would you describe the terrain there?
I'm gonna say it's relatively flat. It's a good walk. I mean, there's a little bit of undulation to keep it interesting, but nothing that is daunting when it comes to being able to go out there one afternoon and take a push cart or carry your clubs and enjoy the afternoon.
And the price is right, Doug. My goodness, right? As a public course, and, you know, it's just so accessible price-wise.
You know, the ISLA presidents, the senior ISLA presidents during the week walk down the fairway for $16.
Unbelievable.
Which is tremendous value for the dollar.
Absolutely. And then what are the other prices?
If you're on, the peak price would be a non-resident during the weekend, riding would be $60.
Mm-hmm.
So the most it gets is 60 with a cart on the weekend. That's the highest price we have.
Right. And you've been there for a number of years replacing Richard Lachlan, correct, who had been there for a long time.
Well, Rich, we call him Richie, spent his entire life here. The one little chit-chat we had about the logo, when I came on board here in 2006, I replaced Richie after retiring, and he was here for probably close to 30 years he was here before he retired. And before that, he was here as a child. And in the process of redoing the pro shop, I stumbled across a photograph of a young boy with a canvas bag over his shoulder standing in front of the putting green. And I found out that it was a childhood photograph of Richie after playing one of his first junior tournaments here when the golf club was private. And I literally kind of took that idea and ran with it and took the photograph. I handed it to a friend of mine, Brian, who was the art director for the local school district, and they created a logo for me, and now the new country club logo, the Brentwood logo, has Richie as part of the face of Brentwood.
I took that picture of you pointing to the logo on a hat, and I'm looking at it right now. So that's Richie with trees right behind him. And
right. Which is part of the old logo. The old logo was kind of like an oval with pine trees in the background. It said Brentwood Country Club. So, and it had like a little flag sticking up. So I kept the pine trees, kept the flag, and then kind of had a little help with the artistry to add Richie into the equation.
Well, what a tribute to Richie. He must have been very delighted.
He's a humble guy. Just a wonderful golf talent. I had the pleasure of walking the fairways with him last week at Shinnecock, and he's up there in years, and he shoots his age more often than not. Tremendous ball striker, great player still today, and just wonderful to be in his presence. He's always got a story. There's always stories, and every story is just more interesting than the next.
How did you play at Shinnecock, which is literally about a 5-wood from here, if you can get a long 5-wood?
Yeah, we decided to go out there and play when the wind was blowing about 35 miles an hour. Which
makes happens every day.
Makes it a whole different experience. Some of the balls are being blown off the green, and I'm not really good at reading the wind in the putt, so you have to kind of balance the break with the wind. But I was out there with Don McDougal, who was the golf professional there for many years.
Oh, wow.
And Richie Lachlan and my fellow professional over at Holbrook, which is our sister course here in the town of Islip, Bill Opoza. And we had, even though it was a windy walk and we all had that red face when we were done with the wind, we had a wonderful day together. The stories were flying. Don and Rich were just, you know, one story after another about how the trees were moved and the bushes and this and the tee boxes. And Billy and I just sat back and just listened the whole day. And
I'm
it was just wonderful.
Sure it was wonderful. Yeah, I mean, the course has changed a lot. Even since I've, you know, started playing it, they removed, you know, most of the trees, if not all of them. But what a challenging historic day that must have been on many levels.
It was fun. I mean, you know, you get Don going, and he's on the tee box, and he says, "Well, now this tee box really wasn't here; it was over there, and the angle of the green was this." And then he's just sitting there going, "Yeah, he's had to be there for 30 years himself." And again, what a gentleman, what a sweetheart. We had a wonderful day. Well, it was just a true golf day.
Oh, a true golf test it really is. And I am delighted to have been asked by the Southampton Hospital to actually MC an auction there. They're going to have a tournament there on October 17th to benefit the Southampton Hospital. And I'm going to go and play and then, you know, host an auction. So hopefully it's very successful. And, you know, I'm just looking forward to that. It's always special when you play Shinnecock. Doug, you're a Class A PGA. You got your status in 1990. And a lot of people don't realize what goes into becoming a Class A PGA. Can you explain what you had to do to get that designation?
Yeah, well, back in the day, there was a little different program than there is today. But back in the day, it was about a 4 or 5 year apprenticeship program that we went through, working underneath fellow Class A professionals, and then doing some tutelage underneath them, doing the day-to-day activities of the golf industry, and then the PGA themselves would send literature and information that we needed to study and understand, and then we went to like different schools, like a week-long school, and then afterward there was an exam. And the exam was pretty intense, and you had to have 70% or better to qualify to go to the next level. And we had to go through three different levels, and then there were several interview processes where we had to teach in front of another professional and be approved that our teaching skills were there. And then we had to do other programs when it comes to, you know, tournament organizations and what have you, and have all the boxes checked that we understood the nature of the industry. They've changed it a little bit right now. We have PGM programs where a lot of that information is now incorporated into a college program, and they have been producing some really, really fine young professionals through that program. And, you know, the way that I did it was old school. The new school is producing a lot of very, very talented young players and professionals.
So how long does it take to get through that program? When you did it, how long did it take to get through it and compared to the program now?
It's about 5 years. When you do it with the PGM program, you have 4 years of your undergrad built in with the PGM program, and then you have that one additional year where you have to do internships at different clubs. You have to hit the different categories, whether you work inside operations, in the pro shop, teaching. You have to hit all the boxes before they give you your Class A status. So it's about 5 years when I did it. It's about 5 years now. And it's very intense. I mean, it is all year round, being involved in the golf industry, learning all the ins and outs to be able to run a full-functioning golf facility at the PGA standard.
And now there are universities that offer the program, right?
Yes, there's several of them. I mean, back in the day, there was only one, and that was Ferris State in Michigan, which I don't know why they chose that place. You didn't play golf at all during the year. But many, many golf, I don't even know the list. I know that... let's see, you got, I think Arizona has a program. I think there's one at NC State. There's one down in Carolina. They're everywhere. I mean, the list is probably about 15, 20 deep compared to years ago there was one.
And when you come out of this program, you learn, you know, everything about really how to run a facility and how to teach. And I mean, you're learning a variety of things, right? The business part of being, you know, a pro, as well as, you know, the instructing part, correct?
Yes. When you become a Class A PGA professional, the amount of hats that you wear at your facility is kind of daunting. Everything from accounting and doing all the Excel spreadsheets and everything on the back end, all the computer work you need for reservations, managing outings, tournament operations, and all of that. You also need to know about merchandising a pro shop, buying, selling, all the marketing aspects. Obviously, now social media is another thing that's added into the equation as well, with all the golf advisor type information that you need to keep putting out about your product and creating your marketing strategies. It's gotten more levels and more layers. Even since I've been involved, every year there's like another layer to the industry being added. And on top of all of that, you have to be able to pass the playing ability test and be able to demonstrate the game at a professional level. And the playing ability test is, if anybody's listening who's trying to go through it, it is the most awkward test, because in golf, we kind of play against the field, and the weather and the conditions kind of determine what a good score is that day. But with the playing ability test, it does not. You have to play 36 holes within 15 strokes of the course rating, no matter what. It could be wind sideways, raining sideways, it doesn't matter. So it is a very
whatever
awkward
is thrown
test
at you on any given day, right?
Yes. The first time I took it, The second 18, it started snowing.
Oh, where? Up here?
Yes, I took it up here at Cold Spring.
Oh,
and
my gosh.
I took it in November, and we had early snow in November. And in the second 18 of my 36 holes, I was on my way to pass the PAT, and the last three holes I had to play in the snow.
Well, you deserve more than the Class A PGA status.
Exactly. I got a merit badge from a Boy Scouts, something for that one.
I love it. Oh, my gosh. Doug Jansen, Head Professional Director of Golf at Brentwood Country Club, joins me. If you had to maybe pinpoint the biggest issue in golf that concerns you at this point, what would it be, do you think?
The growth of the game. The growth of the game really comes down to, especially up here in the Northeast, the youth of today and the new players, they don't have time. To tie up, getting to the golf course, playing golf, getting home, do you have 5-6 hours on the maybe the only 1 or 2 days a week you have off? And we got to find a way to make the game play a little quicker. We got to find a way to make 9 holes more available even during the peak times. We have to do things to allow it so that it fits into everybody's time management.
You've heard of so many different ideas and you know, possible solutions to growing the game. And, a lot of people say, let's just play 12 holes. Everybody has, their own idea. What would you suggest to help grow the game?
Well, depending upon your facility. I mean, there's some facilities that are 27 holes, and they can do 9 holes on the weekend. Again, we got to balance the bottom line. We have to make the revenue. So it really comes down to a cute little balance between everything. I think that, a lot of clubs on Saturday and Sunday morning should try early shotguns and, get them on the golf course at 7 o'clock, get the whole golf course running, and now all of a sudden you have 18 7 o'clock tee times versus one. And get them around the golf course, get them all home, and then reopen the golf course for people who have more time in their day and it can play well into the afternoon. Every facility is a little different. Every clientele is a little different. And just trying to find a balance of who your customers are and who your members are and what works best for them is, again, another hat that we have to wear as the golf professional managing a facility.
Women and juniors are a big portion of that growth, right? Just getting more and more women to play. Women are multitasking. A lot of women are doing the nine and dine kind of thing, playing 9 holes and turning it into, a networking and social event afterwards. Juniors, we have so many opportunities to do so much. A lot of them prefer team sports when they're young, right? So how do you get juniors interested in golf?
The juniors are probably our biggest challenge right now, to kind of get them to put the electronics down and pick up a golf club. And as you know, this game is not easy. And it's no instant gratification in this game, which is something where you get a little bit more in the electronic world. So it's a challenge to get the juniors involved. But I will say, once you do get them involved, they get enamored with the game very quickly, and they love the game very quickly. Just getting opportunity for them to play, getting the organization for them to play. PGA has done a wonderful job with their golf leagues, with the kids, kind of mimicking a little league program. The First Tee program has done a wonderful job mixing community service and community interaction with golf, another great program there. And more importantly, just opportunity. A lot of time when these kids want to play, a parent that they would want to play with may not be available. So, there could be some really good mentor relationships that could be created within the community as well.
And, there's a whole other segment of the population that golf is starting to include, and that's golfers with disabilities. Doug, there's organizations out there. I'm doing a lot of work with the United States Adaptive Golf Alliance, and there are about 30-plus organizations under that umbrella of, people with disabilities who are learning the game and, just how excited and how therapeutic it is for when they hit a golf ball and when they learn how to hit a golf ball and having access to these lessons. And they have a big championship coming up in Las Vegas in early October. And, just having access to the game. And, that there are millions of golfers with disabilities, of people with disabilities who, would love to learn the game and and be able to play. And it's wonderful to see what these organizations are doing to get disabled golfers involved.
Yes, I've had some exposure with working with the disabled. I just started, I've been in the last few years been working with Kelly at the Met PGA, and we do a wonderful program with PGA Hope with the veterans. And you know, a lot of the veterans we work with are retirees, and they don't have any prostheses or anything that they're working with, and some do. I have also worked with some that have lost their sight, and it's just so fulfilling to work with them and spend time with them. The hardest part is that, you know, when you're working with them, they say thank you to me, and I'm looking at them going, no, not the thank you to you. These veterans have done so much and served our country so well. It's just nice to give back. And again, you get that look in their face, that light bulb that goes off. Well, all of a sudden now we've given them a direction of something that they can do that they really can sink their teeth into and enjoy. And it's a program that has been flourishing in the Met section, the PGA Hope. If anybody can look into it and have a, if you are a veteran and you're listening and you want to be part of the program, just reach out to Kelly at the Met section. She would embrace you 100% to come on board. It's a great program.
Absolutely. Quick question before I let you go. Do you think Tiger will win another major?
If the location's right. He's primed to win at Augusta almost all the time. I mean, his game, his ball shape, his mindset, he will outthink the youth today. Even with his body that's struggling, his mind is still as strong as it ever was. If he gets on the right venue with the right weather conditions and he can keep himself healthy, he can be competitive because he will never lose. He'll let everybody else kind of fall on the wayside like happened at the Masters
sure.
This year. A tremendous talent when it comes to managing himself and managing the game. It's just a matter of how healthy he's going to be. That's really the bottom line.
Doug, it's been a pleasure. I'd love to keep talking. We'll have to do it again. Part two coming up in the near future,
my
I
pleasure.
Hope. Thanks so much, and continued success at Brentwood Country Club. Doug Jansen.
Thank you very much. Pleasure.
Thanks so
Bye-bye.
Much. All right, we're going to take a quick break, come back, and replay an interview I did with the great Pat Williams of NBA fame. Sports interview with Alan Gorey brought to you by Dune Jewelry and the Hamptons Rope Collection. Savor the memories with sand from your favorite beach or golf course in timeless pieces for men and women. DuneJewelry.com and by Peak Vision Sunglasses. Zero distortion, unmatched clarity. Change your game. PeakVision.com. Let's get radical with new radicals here. Good morning and welcome back to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori. So glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning from 9 to 10 Eastern Standard Time. You can hear us from anywhere on the planet at 883wppb.org, on podcasts everywhere. And each show is archived at annliguori.com. And joining me now is one of my favorite personalities in sports. He is the consummate overachiever. He's written book number 110. He is a Basketball Hall of Famer. He is a major motivator. I can't just come up with enough words to describe the legendary Pat Williams. Pat, thank you so much for joining me this morning on Sports Interview. How are you, my friend?
Well, Ann, I always like to join you, and it's always stimulating. It's always uplifting, and I'm glad we can hook up. How are you?
I'm good. And, you know, you're where at grandchild's game this morning? Is that where you are in Orlando?
I am. I'm sitting here behind the plate. It's the last game of the year, T-ball. I've got 3 5-year-old grandsons.
Only three grandsons?
Well, these three. I mean, I got many more grandsons.
Because you have 19 children, including 14 adopted from four nations.
Yeah, now almost 20 grandkids. We'll have 20 by the time August rolls around.
Oh, so there are 20 grandkids, I was going to say. Okay, my goodness.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you find the time, Pat Williams, to focus on the kids, this huge family of yours, with everything else you're doing?
Well, Ann, you've got to make it a priority. And above all, what I have learned through parenting and grandparenting, the kids want you at their activities.
They do.
They want you there. They want you there to watch, and they want you there to cheer for them, and they want you there to be supportive of them. Now, I learned that way back, you know, in the middle of my parenting days. The kids in the morning would always say, "Dad, are you going to be at our game tonight?
Dad, it's so important.
You're going to be at our swimming meet." And now it just transfers over to the grandkids' world, and we've gotten pretty good I'm learning and to keep my mouth shut.
You're learning.
That's probably the hardest part. You know, you want to yell at a kid, you know, run, you know.
Exactly, especially with your experience, you know, as a general manager and, you know, coach and athlete. I mean, it must be very hard to, you know, maintain restraint at these games.
There you go. You got my fortunately, my wife, you know, nudges me and says, be quiet. Let the kids play. Let them play.
So, Pat, what are your priorities in life? And I'm sure they've changed through the years, but if you had to say, give me your top three priorities, what are they now?
Well, in faith, you know, my faith is it triggers everything. You know, my faith in God and my walk with Christ, you know, that is number one priority. Number two has to be your family. And number three, I would say everything else. In my case, for 33 years, it's been the Orlando Magic. Prior to that, it was the 76ers. Prior to that, it was the Chicago Bulls. So I think if you can keep things in that order, you're going to have a life that functions a whole lot better. We have a tendency in this business to put the sports world and our job profession above everything else. But if you do that, you're going to be pretty limited. And our business is a heartbreak business, and, you know, it's a suffering business. Most of the time you spend it suffering. So it's important to have that faith and family notch, you know, really carved out well in advance and stay faithful to it.
You've been brilliant at balancing your life, and what a life you've led. I mean, talk about living life to the fullest, Pat Williams. Nobody does it better than you. You just turned 79, and you just announced this past week that you're retiring from the NBA.
Well, Ann, I've been in the NBA 51 years now, and seen it all, done it all. If my math is right, a year from yesterday, I'll be 80. Well, that gets your attention. you begin to think a lot more about your mortality and, above all, your legacy. So I have got a list here, Ann, that I've got to get on. I want to get on. I want to start the Pat Williams Leadership Library. I want to start the Pat Williams Leadership Training Center. I've got a book I must write about all the people that I've met through the NBA, all the way back to the beginning of the league almost. So those are a few priorities. I want to get my doctorate. I want to get my PhD.
Really?
I want to figure out how to do that. Yeah, that's on my checklist. And can I whisper this to you? I've got to lose 50 pounds. I've gotten a little careless. And
you're the one that does all these marathons and works out all the time?
I know.
What happened?
And apple crumb pie from Publix. that's what did it.
The key lime does it to me.
Well,
the key lime pie.
Well, that's huge down in Florida, as you know. And I got careless.
Huh.
And so I've got to really... really get straightened out here, but I will do it. I'm determined to do it. And
so you are leaving the Orlando Magic, so you won't have that day-to-day responsibility, but you're still gonna, you told me you're still gonna go to the games and still
be very much
a part of the team.
Oh, I'll be there every night, you know. I stand. I've never had a seat. I stand in my little spot there on the corner, and I'll continue to do that every night. You know, I'll remain the Magic's number one fan, but I just have to get moving in on so many of these different projects, and I can't do that, in fairness to everybody, you know, if I'm in the Magic office. I had to make this radical move to really get my blood rolling and moving and to have the freedom to really do many of these things that are important to me that would, as I said, it's legacy. What do you want people to remember you by? And I want people years from now to go to that Pat Williams Leadership Library. And I'm a book collector. from the time I was 7 years old when I fell in love with baseball. I've been a book collector, and I've saved them. I've never got rid of a book. So there are about 30,000 of them now.
Unbelievable. Where do you keep these books, Pat Williams?
Well, my wife in the house for a long time, but my wife eliminated that. So they're down at our church, First Baptist Church in Orlando, has agreed to let the library be headquartered there. So right now, these books, there are about 700 cases of them. They are all in storage, and we're working now to figure out where we put this place and how much funding do we have to raise. And I need to be spearheading all of that. But I want that to be a place where people can come, where they can be inspired, and above all, Anne, be motivated to become better readers.
Sure, sure. Because we've lost that art with social media and with, you know, the cell phones, and everybody is, you know, looking at characters under 130 words and symbols. You know what I'm saying? It's just so different now. Do people read books anymore?
Well, Anne, I think that's the point. And there are more good books coming out than ever. I mean, we've got great sports books. We've got great history books. We've got some marvelous, you know, the great authors are still out there. And the average man, upon finishing high school, will not read another book the rest of his life.
Really? It's a terrible statistic.
85% of all the books purchased in this country are purchased by women.
Really?
And we've become a non-reading society. But yet, the greatest deterrent to dementia, the greatest deterrent to Alzheimer's, is reading.
Is that right?
Because our brains need to be exercised.
That's right.
They need to be pushed. It's a muscle. And that muscle needs exercise, and the best exercise I know of is attaching a good book to that cranial muscle.
That's such a great point, Pat Williams. That is such a great point. You have 30,000 baseball books.
Well, they're all books. About 2,000 of them are baseball books.
They're all sports. Okay.
Well, yeah, but more important, I've got a Civil War section. I've got a World War II section. I've got a presidential biography section. These are all the areas that I'm interested in reading. World War II, the Revolutionary War period. In other words, I only read in those areas that are of interest to me.
Yes.
You will find no novels when this place is set up.
Hmm.
You will not find a section on cooking or gardening.
You're not interested in that, obviously.
Yeah, those are just areas that I've, you know, I have never read in, have no real interest, but you'll find over 1,000 books on leadership. You'll find about 900 books on success.
A passion for golf, celebrity musings about the game, is one of those 30,000 that you...
I have a golf section. You know what they say? The smaller the ball, the better the writing.
Exactly. Well, I have to introduce you to a guy named Pat Ruddy, who owns, he used to be a sports writer in Ireland. He owns and designed a course on the east coast of Ireland, just south of Dublin, called the European Club. And Pat Ruddy has the largest collection of golf books that I know of. So you two would have a lot to talk about. Maybe your collection would rival his. But let me ask you, you're saying, you know, you just have to write this next book about all these people that you've met in the NBA. I'm surprised it's not one of your 110 already. But and you have to, you know, this radical move of finally retiring at the age of 79 from the NBA, which you're not retiring at all. You have this whole list of things, you know, that you really you just say you have to do. What drives you? Is it a fear of being idle? Is it a fear of boredom? Why are you so motivated continuously through this, you know, through 79 years of your life?
Well, Anne, as I really reflect on my career, my life, I'm a builder. It started when I was 24, when the Phillies sent me to Spartanburg, South Carolina to run their minor league ball club there. And that was a building job. Then on my various NBA stops, I look back and they were all situations that were at the bottom, and they needed to be built. Coming here to Orlando 33 years ago, trying to create an expansion team from nothing. That was a building job. Well, the Magic are built. Now, I haven't been building a lot recently, and I need to do that. I'm hungry for that. So building this library, building there's a leadership seminar, building, and this, let's say this last decade of my life, although it may be more. Listen, Tony Bennett is still singing at 93, but I want to build again, and I want to have that excitement, you know, pouring through me. So I feel really good about this. I'm encouraged, and so there's lots on my platter here, Ann, and I'm eager to get into it all.
And you have would you consider health wise? Because I know you're in remission from multiple myeloma, correct?
Yes, I was diagnosed. I'm in my ninth year now with multiple myeloma. I'd never heard of it, but it's one of the blood cancers, pretty tough form of cancer. But I'm very fortunate. The chemo has worked. The different forms have worked. I feel good. I'm able to keep my full life. But you begin to think, okay. And then when you see John Havlicek pass away at 79, and you read about some significant sports figures, basketball figures who are dealing with dementia, well, that has certainly got my motor running, Dan.
Sure, sure. So your recovery was really remarkable. You had a stem cell transplant. Is that a common practice in that kind of? Is that a common treatment in this kind of thing, or was it just something special you were able to connect to?
Well, in the first year, they wanted to get me into remission, and it didn't happen. And so the next logical step was the stem cell transplant. I underwent that, I guess that was about 7 years ago now. It doesn't always work, but in my case, it did. And that was a huge step for me. So, yes, part of the treatment that's out there is a stem cell transplant, and many people undergo it. It sounds fearful. But it's not really, it's not painful. They harvest your stem cells for a couple of days and then freeze them. And then after getting your body thoroughly cleaned out, they put them back in. They put these cells back in. It's amazing to me how it works. But in my case, it was effective, and I came out of it in good shape, and the doctors have... keep an eye on me, but there's no need to redo it. Some people will go back two or three times to do it. But stem cell transplants, they're quite amazing.
Where did you have it done, Pat Williams?
Right here.
In Orlando?
Right here. Yeah. Now, there's some marvelous cancer centers in New York, in Houston, in Boston, but really what I found out, they're all in touch with each other, and so you don't have to go off to the big city. These oncologists all compare notes, they all talk to each other, and you can get effective treatment just about anywhere.
That's just incredible, that kind of treatment, and thank goodness it worked with you. You're on the board of directors for the Multiple Myeloma Research Foundation, so you're educating a lot of people about this this process and about, you know, this disease, and what is your slogan? The mission is remission.
That's right, Ann. I came up with that. The mission is remission. I wrote a book a few years ago, still in print, about my experience with multiple myeloma. And it is amazing the number of myeloma patients who have gotten that book. They'll want to call. They want to talk. They need somebody who's been through it. And I feel comfortable talking to them and telling them what I learned. And above all, I tell them, don't panic here, you know. It sounds frightening. It sounds like a death sentence, but don't panic. And I tell them two things. Listen to your doctors, above all. And number two, stay optimistic. Stay positive. You know, those are two pretty good pieces of advice.
Tell me about character carved in stone, the 12 core virtues of West Point that build leaders and produce success. It's your, what, 110th book, Pat. Incredible.
Well, and here's what happened. A few years ago, I was invited to go to West Point and speak to the teams there, the sports teams at Army. And afterwards, they gave me a tour of the campus, which was quite an experience. I loved that. Anyway, we ended up in a little park on the campus called Trophy Point, which sat over the Hudson River. And I noticed in this park there was a series of benches. I counted them. There were 12 stone benches. And that prompted me to look closer, and I noticed on each bench there was a word carved into the stone, a different word, words like courage and responsibility and trust, service, those kind of words. And I thought there has to be a backstory here. And there was. The West Point class of 1934 donated those benches to the school, designed with those words to inspire future classes of young military leaders coming along. And then my thought was, boy, what a story this is. I said, sure is a well-kept secret. I'd never heard of it, but I thought, so we went to the publisher, said, here's the idea. Let's do a chapter, each different word, and then we'll try and figure out West Point graduates who best modeled that word. So that's what we did. We found some fascinating stories about West Point grads from Eisenhower and MacArthur and Mike Krzyzewski, who's a West Point guy.
Right. Coach K wrote the intro.
He did. He wrote the foreword. And we featured him in the chapter on responsibility. We had a really interesting time putting the book together. It's been after a short while now, and we're greatly encouraged with some of the early feedback, Anne. But Character Carved in Stone, that's the latest book we've done.
It's so incredible. Inspiring stories, informative lessons, and the 12 core values that make Army West Point one of the most successful and powerful leadership institutions in the world. And what I love about you is you're always thinking of the next project. You never are idle. You always have so many things going on. You're such an inspiration, Pat Williams. Before I let you go, give us some words of wisdom that we can think about all day.
All righty. That was Pat Williams and my conversation I had with him a few months ago. Just an incredible human being. I thank Pat Williams. I thank Doug Jansen, the head professional at Brentwood Country Club, and a shout out to Cecilia Liguori, Gene, and Steve Skidgel in Cocoa Beach, who are listening to Sports Interview over breakfast. Have a great weekend, everybody. Talk to you next Saturday morning right here on Sports Interview with Anne Liguori.